I call this meeting of the Committee on Energy, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum. Our first item of business is the approval of the minutes. Representative Meckland, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I would move the minutes from March 4th, 2025.
I have a motion to approve the minutes from March 4th, 2025. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. All right. With that, we have House File 1852, Representative Murphy. If you'd like to move your bill and make your motion and let us know about your bill.
Yep, so, I'd like to Representative move Murphy. House File 1852. To the general register.
All right.
House File 1852 establishes a solar setback to help protect our county parks, our state parks, and wildlife management areas. We're really protecting our environment of natural resources, protects our animal habitat with adequate landing spaces, and also ensures safe distances for our hunters. And so with that, I believe there's a couple people maybe that will help talk today. Do we have a couple testifiers?
Yes, we do have some testifiers on the bill. If you're ready for, is there any questions generally for the bill author? Well, we have Eric Simonson with the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association.
Hey, how you doing?
Mr. Simonson, if you'd introduce yourself for the committee and please us with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Simonson. I'm a lobbyist representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. MDHA is an organization of over 11,000 plus members, men, women, and youth statewide. Organization was created by hunters and for hunters, and for the last 40 plus years have been building a hunting and conservation legacy through habitat, education, and advocacy. We are grateful to Representative Murphy for bringing House File 1852. We are happy to support this bill, especially as it relates to WMAs. WMAs in Minnesota represent more than 1.3 million acres of habitat, which is also recreation for hunters and trappers, including white-tailed deer hunting. Deer hunting has over a $500 million impact on Minnesota's economies every single year. Over the past 10 years, Minnesota has fielded an average of 475,000 hunters per season. Not all of those hunters going afield have private land to hunt on, and many of them utilize WMAs and other public lands to hunt and harvest deer. By establishing this setback requirement, we feel much more confident that hunters won't have to worry about unintended damage to energy generating systems or any interaction with the generating systems at all. Hunters take safety very seriously, and if there are policies that we can support that accomplish our goals, we are happy to do that. Thanks again for the opportunity to support House File 1852, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Simonson at all? You know, I just maybe have one myself, just from a standpoint of kind of proximity, like just generally from a deer hunting standpoint, kind of what are some of the rules when it comes to, you know, if you're shooting at a deer or whatnot and how that could potentially affect that. You said it could potentially cause damage. Kind of what's some of the scenarios, distances, and some of those things? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it's a very good question, and I think that any damage that we would be talking about would completely be unintended damage. I think, you know, most hunters that are in the field take what they're doing very seriously when it comes to safety. And one of the very first things that you learn in any gun safety class as a youth is that make sure you know not only what you're shooting at, but what's on the other side of what you're shooting at. I think our support for this bill is around just making sure that we minimize anything that's unintended, as well as any interaction with that equipment at all. Some of these WMAs are relatively small, and there's not a lot of room there, but we would take that setback as something that's important to preserving that WMA for hunting.
Does it, Mr. Simonson, does the solar systems restrict movement at all to animals as far as, you know, from a construction standpoint, or how would that potentially affect just the movement of deer or pheasants or whatever?
Mr. Chair, another good question, and you're asking some things that we don't have a lot of data on yet. You know, some of these systems that have been installed already are not in areas where we've had a lot of exposure to. but obviously any construction or anything new in the field that white-tailed deer are exposed to, they're going to be nervous at first, but eventually it becomes part of the background and they kind of blend together. And it's just like any other good neighbor. These things can coexist together, and we feel comfortable with that sort of a buffer zone.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question probably for the testifier. Are there any other land uses that have this sort of a setback requirement? So you're talking about a setback for solar energy here, but are there any other land uses where there is this type of a three-quarter of a mile setback requirement that's currently in place?
Mr. Simonson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, not that I'm aware of, not to that degree or that distance, I should say. There certainly are setback requirements for different pieces of property based on what the use of that property is, but I'm not familiar with one that's quite that significant.
Representative Akam, I believe in statute, and maybe Mr. Eloff could explain, but under current law, I believe for WMAs and potentially even state parks, there is a half-mile restriction for wind turbines. So wind turbines are limited on how close they could be built to WMAs and state parks, if I believe that to be correct. But this was a couple of years ago conversation, so that might be wrong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Akam, I'm not sure either, but we're going to hear testimony from the Public Utilities Commission, which would have set those setbacks. So that might be the first question we want to ask.
Certainly. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I know that typically, and there has been a bill for a solar or a statute for the solar, and it has to do with the diameter of the blades. So it does change with the size of the blades over time. In 2023, the average size of a diameter of the blades was 438 feet, and they required five lengths of that before. So it was nearly a half mile.
Sounds good. We got a list here. Representative Carroll.
Chair, and if you can help me out, I'm having trouble understanding why there can't be peaceful coexistence between solar and the parks and the wildlife. I mean, that happens in other applications. There's grazing, for example, with pastures under solar. Why couldn't it be in this case?
I left the photo of one.
Representative Murphy.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I left the photo for you, and it's a photo of a wildlife management area near Osakis. I was an area that I spent a lot of time calling on dairy farmers. And if you look at how close that those solar panels are to an area that a pheasant hunter or a duck hunter would be in, it wouldn't surprise you much if, and a lot of times they take off, and I know they're great when they get the wind, and sometimes your rounds will go different areas. And so it's really for the protection of any liability that the hunter would have. Because in that case, because we don't have any kind of requirement, you can see that it's a very close distance to the wildlife area. In some cases, only around 50 feet. And so that's why you want to establish some type of level. But because, if you're pheasant hunting or duck hunting, for instance, or deer hunting, we want to give a little more protection for the people that are using our natural resources, too, so they don't have to, cause damage that now they're responsible for. So part of it's for protection of them as well.
Thank you. Representative Carroll, do you have a follow-up to that?
Well, I'll hold. I do, but I'll hold.
We got time.
No, that's okay.
Okay. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. It's an interesting one to talk about. I'm curious about, for your testifier, what land uses do you find outside of WMAs?
Mr. Simonson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not quite sure I understand the question, but do you mean adjacent to WMAs?
Representative Jones, does that?
Correct, okay. Yes, adjacent to.
Mr. Simonson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you'll find all sorts of different properties abutting WMAs, primarily state land, county land, other public lands, could be private land, could be an easement in between the WMA and some other type of land. But there's any number of different types of neighboring occupancies.
Representative Jones?
Thank you. That's helpful to know, just for some questions for later. I'm also curious, are there, I appreciate the thought around, you know, keeping people safe, keeping equipment safe, and that type of thing. Are there other strategies besides just physical distance to create that protection? And this is maybe to, not to the testifier, but to the bill author.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Jones. No, I don't think so. I mean, this is just for protection. If unless you want to have people that use our natural resources for pheasant, duck hunting, whatever, unless you want them to start in just the middle so they can't harm anything, that would be the only thing. I mean, if we are allowing these acres, and in this case, too, a lot of these acres are what were actually the farmer's acres that he worked with the state of Minnesota so that we would have these spaces. And so then we are able to use those spaces. But this just protects everybody involved. And the goal of this was so we have these type of management areas for us to use. And we want our hunters and we want our people, our citizens of the state, to be able to use these areas. And it restricts their use if we have a solar panel within 50 feet of where they could cause damage and now they're liable.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer. I'm representative for the answer. So I think we can think a little bit more creatively. Actually, the PUC has required on various projects and other entities have as well to use berms or, you know, fencing, trees. There are other ways that we can make sure that we're protecting both individuals' rights to use the WMAs as well as and the solar farms themselves. So I just want to make sure that, like, we are thinking creatively. There are other strategies out there, and wanted to put that out there.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Murphy, for bringing the bill. And this maybe is not the right time to ask these questions, but they're just, like, popping up in my head, so I'm just figure I'll shout them out. So I guess my first question is, why 3/4 of a mile? You just said, you know, you could be within 50 feet or 50 yards and shoot it, but 3/4 of a mile is substantially larger than 50 feet or 50 yards, right? So was there any, how do we get to that number?
Representative Murphy.
Chair, Representative Hollins. It's about 4,000 feet. So it gives some protection if you're depending on what type of round you're using. It gives protection to the hunter so that that doesn't come into play. The other thing that's different, you know, we use a half mile for solar but wind is way up high in the air. Part of the benefit of these areas is where they're placed. They're in the country. Why do we want to put a fence around a wildlife area that you can't see over? We want to be able to see past. Mm-hmm. And so we want to actually be able to feel like it's not encroaching right on the top of us. And that's why we went to all the work of making sure that these areas were set aside. So as far as the 3/4 mile, I think 4,000 feet being just a little bit farther than with the windmill. Windmills are up a lot higher. We're typically not in play as easily. But the solar panels will be more in play, and that's why I think a 3/4 mile distance would be a lot more applicable.
Representative Hollins, you have a follow-up to that?
I do. So, So looking at what the average rifle shot is, I see 200 yards, 300 yards for a very good shot, recognizing that, you know, that can vary, right? And like you said, wind, et cetera. It seems like 3/4 of a mile is really extensive. And I guess my other thought around this is there some way that we can look at liability? I guess I'm a lawyer, so lawyer brain on, right? Is there a way for us to look at liability and reducing the liability of people who are hunting in this space so that if you are hunting in a space that is within, you know, X number of feet of solar panels, that it's, you know, there's some assumed risk of the people who own those solar panels. I'm trying to figure out how we can thread the needle here because I recognize what you're saying, and I love state parks, like, love them. But I also recognize that, especially when we look at some of these spaces, allowing people to put these solar panels in their on their land, right? When we restrict it, it's restricting what people can do with their own land. And I know your side of the aisle does not like that. And then also, we recognize that sometimes that is make or break for them being able to keep that land, right? To be able to afford it, to make it generating money. And so I appreciate what you're trying to do here. I just feel like there's got to be a narrower way to get at this that, that addresses your concern, but also the concerns of the landowners who have decided to invest in solar in that space that benefits them for revenue purposes, but also benefits our grid and what we're trying to do at the state level. So that's less of a question and more of a think about liability, and I am happy to work through that with you also.
Representative Tapke? We do have other testifiers too, so if it's directly towards Mr. Simonson or we've got some other folks too, I mean, whatever, we're good, so. Go for it.
Whatever you'd like me to do.
Yeah.
Okay. So this all, piggybacking what Representative Hollins is talking about, this all kind of confuses me as to where you're at, because I'm looking at your photo and you're worried and concerned, and I don't have any problem with concerns about impacting solar and things like that, but you've also got the Osakis Creamery, you've got the Hot Rod Shop, you've got A to Z Repair, you've got downtown Osakis, and everywhere lots dozens, well over dozens of houses that are all within a three-quarter mile of this specific example that you're bringing up here. Many farmsteads, like, if that's what you're concerned about, and of the safety of hunting in this area, why would solar be the number one result of what should be within a three-quarter mile setback when you've got little kids' playgrounds, you've got businesses, you've got dozens and dozens of homes and businesses through here. So why is solar the focus of this when there are, to me, I mean, solar, you can't, no one can die, like no one can get shot as a solar panel, and you've got little kids playing within three quarters of a mile. Like why are you deciding to go at solar on this instead of the broader safety issues?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tapke. First of all, I know this area well. There's not dozens of kids there. That is a co-op. That's a customer. I know them well. There's one farm, and he's the guy that sold, most likely stole or gave up the land for the state so we could have this benefit. It really is because there is no setback, and this one is very close. And so this is not to do anything with grandfathering them in. This has to do with just new permitting and making sure that we think outside the box. So if a farmer, a landowner, a neighbors like the co-op people, if they have land and they say this would be a great land to work a deal with the state, they just have to think about that. As far as private property rights, 100%. That's not ours to deal with. But in this case, the state has made a big investment here, and the state has made an investment for the people. That's why I think it's really important that we have something, and it should be a little bit further out than solar, in my opinion. And so, you know, if we were looking at a number that was a little different, I don't think we're talking that many feet. And so, but that would be my definition of really why I think it's important that we have a space. And I don't think three quarters of a mile or 4,000 feet is a bad idea from the few state and county parks and wildlife management areas that we have.
Representative Tapke.
And just so that's an argument that actually makes more sense to me as to the state investment in things on there. But that's not the argument that I was hearing you making. I was hearing you making a safety issue argument for why this bill should be passed. I still don't know if I agree with where you're at. On this, but I just appreciate having the conversation, so thank you.
Super.
Thank you. Representative Murphy. You stole my clothes, by the way. Just
stole my clothes.
Happy to do it.
All right. You know, we have some more testifiers here. We have Madeline Samarillo from the American Clean Power Association. If you want to come to the testifier table and give us your name and let us know what you think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Madeline Smarillo with the American Clean Power Association. It's all right. You'll all get it someday. I am here to testify against this piece of legislation for a variety of reasons, beginning with the fact that the three-quarter of a mile setback is not grounded in science. There is no reason for us to think that solar needs to be set back that far from essentially any other type of land use, given that solar is a very peaceful and calm existence on the landscape. It can help variety of types of soil, vegetation, and be a facilitator for habitat for various types of wildlife as well, including pollinators. And we appreciate the fact that ACP, American Clean Power, we represent a variety of members who do all sorts of different things on their solar projects that can allow them to be a fantastic co-locator on the landscape. As far as proximity to wildlife management areas, county parks, and state parks, ACP does not think that it's reasonable to jeopardize the property rights of surrounding landowners and punish them for living next to certain types of other land uses. If a landowner decides to lease their land to a solar project, for example, in the circumstance that Representative Hollins mentioned, for revenue purposes, to maintain that land in their family for years to come, we don't see a reason why they should be inhibited from doing so simply because they happen to live within 3/4 of a mile of a variety of types of land uses. And then finally, it's very, very important to mention that these issues are discussed at the Public Utilities Commission on a project-by-project basis. The Public Utilities Commission works hard to coordinate and is mandated by state legislation to coordinate with a variety of state agencies on issues like this to ensure that projects are being sited responsibly, that impacts to the environment are being taken into consideration, and there's ample opportunity with each individual project docket for public stakeholders to come forward and raise concerns if something like that were to arise. That's all part of the process that we already do. And so it's the position of ACP that this legislation is unnecessary, not based in science, and directly jeopardizes the property rights of surrounding landowners. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? All right. Thank you. And we have George Damian from the Clean Energy Economy. Your testimony.
Thank you, Treasurer Zdinsky and committee members. My name is George Damian. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Clean Energy Economy of Minnesota, also known as SEEM. SEEM is an industry-led, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization representing the business voice of clean energy in Minnesota. Our 70-plus member companies employ tens of thousands of Minnesotans statewide. I am here to express opposition to House File 1852, which would impose a 3/4 mile setback for permitting large-scale solar near state parks, near state and county parks, as well as wildlife areas. This bill significantly restricts landowners' ability to make decisions about their own property, limiting their right to diversify their income streams by participating in the energy economy. At a time of growing energy demand and increased pressure on the electric grid, utility-scale solar is one of the most cost-effective and reliable solutions. This bill would create unnecessary barriers, making it hard to meet the state's energy needs and slowing progress towards a cleaner, more resilient grid. We support approaches that reduce barriers for businesses to site and permit energy infrastructure. Now, more than ever, speed to market to integrate low-cost generation like solar to meet the needs of our modern economy is crucial, all while maintaining a strong community engagement in the process. Minnesota already has a permitting process that ensures responsible siting while balancing environmental and land use considerations, and that happens with the PUC. Additional restrictions like this will only deter investment, but also hurt rural communities that benefit from solar development through new tax revenue, land lease payments, and job creation. Rather than impose obstacles to Minnesotans, we should respect the rights of landowners to decide how to use their property. Utility-scale solar provides a vital economic opportunity, offering stable income for farmers and landowners, generating tax revenue for local communities, and supporting the more than 5,000 Minnesotans employed in our state's growing solar industry. Restricting solar development would take these opportunities away at a time when we need energy more, not less. I respectfully ask the committee to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Just a general question I thought of. You talked about barriers, and Representative Murphy, I was just kind of looking at your map that you had sent, and, you know, we were talking about kind of land use and barriers, and I'm wondering, just having driven by solar farms, you know, I think it's you're normally surrounded by, maybe Mr. Damian, you can answer this, are they like 8-foot fence around on these, or what's kind of normally in the public space, what's around these solar arrays?
I don't have that exact, I don't exactly know what that is off the top of my head.
Maybe Mr. Adeline? Smirlo? You look like you might be, I think I got your name right this time.
Thank you.
So.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, if you'd like to.
So it's typical for fencing requirements to fall in whatever the fencing and safety requirements are under the state. I believe that typically ranges from 5 to 8 feet is a typical range. It also varies by the specific project. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You know, it's just, you know, appreciate that. Just kind of thinking from a practical standpoint, you know, if you, from a, Representative Murphy brought up the fact of safety for, you know, protecting the solar panels from being shot or potentially hit, and then also land use, because, you know, just going through hunter safety, you know, one of the things that I remember being taught is to always understand what's not only there, but what's potentially beyond your what you're shooting at. And so, like if you're looking at that picture, let's just say you had an animal or something that you were hunting was either next to the fence, obviously you couldn't hunt that. And so even if you were half a mile into the property, you wouldn't even be able to hunt on the state property. So when you've got, you know, essentially this would be your field, and you have, if I'm understanding your bill correctly, Representative Murphy, you know, if you've got an 8-foot fence potentially even surrounding a WMNA or at least along the side, you know, especially when it comes to deer, and I understand that's probably why the Deer Hunters Association came up here, is that just the legitimacy of freedom of movement, you know, fair chase, you know, that oftentimes in Environment Committee we hear about the ability for fair chase when it comes to the actual movement of animals, that they're not being penned in essentially. And, you know, when you look at conflict, and it was brought up by Representative Jones about, well, why are we, you know, kind of singling out solar? And I think probably is because it's the very uniqueness of, and there's probably some more pictures of this site, and they're probably not alone, but, you know, just the physical barrier of having an 8-foot fence next to a place obviously is going to limit the ability to, one, use it, but two, for wildlife to move in and out of a property that was, you know, essentially deemed by the state appropriate for public use and also for management of wildlife and the movement of wildlife in and out. And I think from a hunting standpoint, that's probably why the state parks were included too, is that foundationally, when you think of a state park, the wildlife isn't simply contained to the borders of the state park, but the natural movements in and out of the park, whether that be deer or turkey, or pheasants or whatever lives in them, you know, have the ability to go find feed, come back, move back into the park, and, you know, legitimately, you know, the interest is you're going to fence in the wildlife or exceptionally limit the ability for wildlife to move. And, you know, I think this bill is actually probably right on target when it comes to siting. You know, you wouldn't necessarily put things that are in direct contrast. Right, you wouldn't, if someone lived in the middle of a section or someone lived someplace, you wouldn't think it would be appropriate for them to be fenced in by one of these projects, even if, and maybe the same thought process is, why would we limit a big state impact, a big state expenditure with a solar farm? Because I'm just looking at this map, like, as a hunter, I'm looking at it going, boy, how would I hunt that property? One, protect the solar panel, but two, actually, you know, you'd maybe chase the deer up against the fence and then surround them so that they can't run, and then they squirt out the side and you shoot them. I mean, you know, the opportunity for some, you know, interesting. It's an interesting bill, and appreciate you bringing it forward. So, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Murphy, I'm looking at this picture you put out. It looks like it's a farm that's here. Is that right?
It is.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you. Representative Murphy, so with the farmer, it looks like there's some other crops or something there too. Would they be allowed to grow, I don't know, soy, corn, raspberries? Would they be allowed to graze cows in this area?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kraft. It's their land. As long as they own the land, they're able to. The one thing that, you know, that just to go off of what Chair Swazinski talked about, is that's a wetland area. What's at the bottom of wetland? Water. And water's lower. That's why there's water there. Uh-huh. So when you're standing near the water and you're firing toward the solar panels or anything else, that can be a problem. The interesting thing about the solar, The wind requirements is it says that wind turbines shall be located no closer than 1,000 feet. That's a permitted number. That most likely that had to happen for that to even take place. Some type of requirement was there. Either it was because the landowner owned the land and forgave that, but there's a reason for it. But no, it's up to the landowner how he wants to use his land. But it would also be part of the contract that says we want to buy it for the state property.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. We're not talking about wind right now, though. So I imagine, so a couple things. One is the thing you just said of a hunter firing towards the solar panel is a little bit scary. But I imagine the farmer would be allowed to put a fence on their property if they wanted to protect it, I don't know, let's say from deer coming and eating their produce, correct?
Representative?
Their property.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair? Yes, Mr. Representative Kraft, yeah, they'd be doing whatever they want.
Yeah, so, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to let it be known here that I believe this side of the aisle here is going to be voting in favor of property rights because that's what this is. You know, we've just gone through that it's okay to have, by the way, if it was a berry farm there, sometimes those are going to have to be picked. I imagine the liability to a hunter that's firing in, you know, the way they're not supposed to be, you know, at the edge of a WMA into private property would be pretty bad if they hit someone picking berries as bad or worse as hitting a solar panel. So this bill, what I've just taken us through, seems to be very clearly singling out solar when there are other uses that have at least as much, if not more, potential concern and liability and potential loss of life. So I really would urge, in defense, colleagues on the other side, in defense of people's property rights, please vote this down.
Representative Murphy, are there any other questions to the testifiers or to Representative Murphy? Oh, we got Representative Kraft. Or Representative Akam. There we go.
This was Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to start out by asking for a roll call, please. And so thanks for the discussion today. I find this an interesting discussion. First question I have for Representative Murphy is you are using this picture as a demonstration. Do you have any estimate of what size solar array that is?
Representative Murphy.
Chair Swazinski and Representative Akam, it's quite a bit bigger than that. I just shrunk it in there so you could see that it was a wetland. It actually surrounds the wetland there. And it's very close to I-94. We find a lot of them are. But it's really close to the interstate and the off-ramp to Osakis. But it goes beyond that to the south, too.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I ask is because the bill as it's written today is targeted toward 50 megawatt arrays, and as seen in the picture, that certainly doesn't look like a 50 megawatt array. So as demonstrated, it wouldn't even apply to the situation that you're using as an example. And I will also say that I will just say that when my husband and I lived in northern Minnesota, he was a hunter, and so when we first moved there, he would hunt on public land and found it you know, you don't know who you're hunting next to. And so we ended up being fortunate enough to buy some property because it was really important to him that he have the place to be able to hunt safely. And I think that, you know, the surrounding area around you is certainly a consideration here and in other places. And if it's that's the case, not every parcel of land is appropriate for hunting. And so I will just say that I think that there are a lot of wonderful things that we can do on wildlife management areas in addition to hunting. I certainly am a supporter of hunting and all of those things, but not everywhere on public land is appropriate for hunting. But that said, on WMAs, we have gas utility lines that run through some WMAs, which might even pose a larger risk or danger when hunting. So I think that it was stated earlier that it feels like this is more an issue about let's try to prevent solar from being there than it is to prevent unintended hunting incidents. And so I think my husband was also a firearm safety instructor, and to the point made earlier, knowing where your bullet is going, that is certainly an important issue. And so I think there are ways that we can use berms on private land, not to encumber the wildlife management area, but there are ways that we can help provide a buffer between different uses. And so I have concerns about this for many reasons, a 3/4 mile setback, and to kind of compare that to the wind setback of 1/2 mile because of height. I'm glad the author recognized that solar panels are not nearly as high as wind turbines. So using that as a scale doesn't feel like a very appropriate setback. And so with that, I thank you for the opportunity to make some comments. I would encourage members vote no.
And just a general comment too, appreciate the job you did, Representative Murphy, on the presentation of this bill. But just adding to the conversation, it's interesting that, you know, the property tax or the property rights argument is fun. I get it, right? But it's, you know, when we look at a regulatory committee, this committee has cut its teeth on telling generators, electrical, where and where you cannot generate, right? This is an electrical generation plant, right? So whether it's a coal plant, let's say a rural cooperative decided to go out and buy a section of land. They own it. It's private property. Or maybe they rent it from a farmer. Should it be their right to build it? Or would this legislative body step in and say, we want to have a word to say about it? Right? So if that's the conversation we're having, then if we're, you know, living in a world where it's open, that's one conversation I'd love to have, where whatever you want to do on your property, whatever you want to build on your property, you know, when you think of cities and how they manage housing, you can build 6 houses here and then an apartment building there and then a park there. It's not the city's property. It's not the county's property. There's a developer that owns it. Shouldn't we allow them to build the housing that they can have the most profit from? No, we decide as legislators and city councilmen and elected officials what we feel is the best use. And I think Representative Murphy's bill does thread a needle that I think we've gotten awfully used to, saying, you know, well, we really just need to leave this between property owners and the state. You know, these things are not being built on their own. There are billions of dollars from the federal government, state governments, state mandates that are building them and pushing them to be built. If they were just being built on a free market, great, let's have that conversation, but they're not. They're being built and implemented and put into the public space at the public, you and I's, direction. And we have to decide as a legislature when those things are built on the public dime, in the public space that I say is this, the energy space, whether or not we should have a conversation about it. And I get the idea of property right. If we want to have that bill, I will chief author that one, where if you want to build it, let them come without regulatory, sounds good. I'll co-author that bill with you, and we'll just make sure that it's across the board. But I'm going to let Representative Jones have something to say. You have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy, again to this bill. Well, first, I'd like to say, Mr. Chair, I would love to talk about making it easier to build more housing throughout the state and deregulating our land use in cities. I'm very serious about that. I think we have a big housing problem, and I think we can find some commonalities there. Another thing that was mentioned, I'll just say the free market doesn't exist in the energy space. It just does not. We have been subsidizing fossil fuels since 1913. So I'll put that aside. I agree that we also need a reason to regulate. And so that's why we're having this conversation. Should we put a regulation on this private property? Representative Murphy mentioned in his presentation about or trying to answer the question, what is the thing that we're trying to solve? And one of the things that I really commend Representative Murphy on is the desire to encourage wildlife, you know, around our state parks, around the WMAs. I love that. And so we heard from our first testifier that land use, though, does exist of all types exist around these areas. Some that support wildlife and some that don't. And Representative Kraft, I think, noted that, you know, they could be agriculture. They could have fencing around them. I think you had mentioned there was a co-op nearby. So they're all different types of uses. So some that encourage habitat and some don't. One thing I want to mention about every project that I know of that is over 50 megawatts has been built recently for solar has had a pollinator habitat requirement from the PUC. So that is encouraging wildlife and more so than taking away from it. So that encourages pheasants, turkeys. I recognize, you know, if we put berms and other things like that, deer would have a hard time getting in there. But that still provides that benefit in ways that residential or farming may not have that benefit. I also want to get to the distance piece. So we're sitting here in the Capitol. The cathedral is 0.6 miles away. We have to go all the way to the James J. Hill House to reach 3/4 of a mile. Representative Hollins mentioned that, you know, a gun can fire 200 to 300 yards. So that's less, that's much, much smaller than that. So I'm going to close here. You mentioned thinking outside the box, Representative Murphy, and safety. If safety is one of your true concerns, again, we're trying to get to this. Why do we need a reason to regulate? We talked about the natural areas. I think solar provides one of those things, or a lot of that benefit. And if safety is a true concern, though, I encourage thinking about liability mechanisms, buffers, berms, tree foliage, fencing. There are a lot of creative solutions there that don't restrict property owners nearly as much from being able to put solar on them. So thank you.
Final thoughts?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Jones. First of all, a rifle can fire a lot farther than that. So we have gun ranges in my county that are 1,250 yards times three. Almost the 4,000 feet that we're talking about. And so you can get that. And when you fire from an area that's 20 or 30 or 40 feet lower than where you're aiming at, guess where the round is going? So that can make a difference. One of the thoughts we had about the picture, and you said, well, is this one big enough? We're not talking about existing. We're talking about newly permitted. And so we always have rules. In wind, we have statute that tells us what we can do, 1,000 feet from a home or residence, and almost a half-mile setback. But in solar, we don't. We don't have a setback. And so this is really to establish that. And especially when the taxpayers made huge investments in these areas, and it typically comes from a landowner that also has a similar interest. And so we've made the investment, and to go back to Representative Taffy's point, this is to preserve the investment. The public safety part was basically so that we don't, we're not liable for hurting someone's property that we could actually be liable for to pay for. And no one wants to pay for solar panels if they're out deer or pheasant hunting. So with that, this is about preserving our investment. It's investment we've made in our county parks, our state parks, and our wildlife management areas. And those are ours, the citizens of ours. We should be protecting that. And this is on future permitting, so landowners will fully know if this is an option that they want, because it will be part of the process. Nobody's saying we're going back and adjusting somebody's property by taking down solar panels. So with that, I'll that's all I have, I guess. Thanks.
All right. Representative Murphy renews his motion that House File 1852 be referred to the General Register. The CLA will take the roll.
Chair Swidzinski.
Aye.
Vice Chair Murphy.
Aye.
Lead Acomb.
No.
Representative Kraft.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson, aye.
Representative Baker.
Yes.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Frazier.
No.
Representative Hollins.
No.
Representative Igo.
Yes.
Representative Jones.
No.
Representative Mahmoud.
No.
Representative Mekland.
Yes.
Representative Sexton.
Yes.
Representative Weiner.
Yes.
There being 8 ayes and 7 nays, the most passes, and the bill is on its way to the General Register. All right, the next item of business, we have a couple of budget overviews. We'll start with the Department of Commerce. If you'd like to come up to the testifying table, introduce yourself. We look forward to hearing from you. Commissioner Arnold, if you want to start us off, introduce yourself. We'd love to.
Great. All right. Good afternoon, Chair Swidzinski, Representative Acomb, members. For the record, I'm Grace Arnold, the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and with me today is Deputy Commissioner Pete Wyckoff and Assistant Commissioner Lissa Polish. Thanks for inviting me to walk through the work the department does in the energy space and present on the governor's budget proposals. I'll start by just giving a bit of an overview of commerce. For 150 years, the Minnesota Department of Commerce and its predecessor agencies have served Minnesotans. We protect and assist Minnesota consumers. We oversee and regulate more than 40 industry areas to protect consumers and ensure a strong, competitive, and fair marketplace. And we work to engage people in communities across the state. Commerce is carrying out our mission through five strategic priorities, which are to protect the public interest, serve as a trusted resource, reduce economic barriers, build resilience in the face of our changing climate, and work to foster a strong, competitive, and fair marketplace in Minnesota. Our Division of Energy Resources is led by Deputy Commissioner Pete Wyckoff, who you will hear from just shortly, and is organized into two teams, the Federal and State Initiatives team under Assistant Commissioner Polish, who you will also hear from, focuses on reducing the cost of energy, particularly for low-income Minnesotans, and leveraging state and federal funding to transition to a carbon-free electric generation sector in the state. Regulatory Affairs is under our Assistant Commissioner Sydney Lieb. That represents the state of Minnesota at the PUC to ensure that our energy transition is low cost for ratepayers and produces reliable energy generation, is fair to all Minnesotans, and is meeting our climate goals. The Division of Energy Resources at the Department and the Walz Administration is leading the way in climate solutions, and we've reduced greenhouse gas emissions, improved energy efficiency, and invested in climate resilience across the board in our division. So I'll now hand it over to Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff to run through the bulk of our presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representatives. As was said, I'm Deputy Commissioner Pete Wyckoff of the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Energy. I want to give a brief overview as we head into discussing about where our funding comes from. That is, what is it that Minnesota is doing, and what is it that Commerce does as part of that? Well, Minnesota is moving, just like everywhere else, through an energy transition. That is driven in part in this state by intentional policy. The biggest one that we are working on implementing with the PUC is the 100% carbon-free electricity standard by 2040. On the climate side, that feeds into and is an important driver for meeting the statutory goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions economy-wide by mid-century. At Commerce, our job is to make sure, however the energy system develops, it is developing in a way that is fair, affordable, and reliable. The good news is that this move to clean is actually compatible with the move to affordable. In fact, they are intimately related. 2 years ago, this body charged my unit with conducting a study on the energy storage needs for Minnesota going forward. And when you do a study like that, you actually model the whole electric system. And when we did that, it produced optimal pathways forwards for what would be the affordable way to meet our goal. And I'll show you in a second that that is an affordable way no matter what. What we anticipate in Minnesota meeting 2040 with the most affordable way forward, that we're doing further modeling on this, is a system that has a lot of gas still on it, but these gas plants aren't used very much. That is the top bar on this. Blue is what we have today. Green is what we would need. What we anticipate is a continued move away from uneconomical coal. Those are high dollars per megawatt units. And a move away from peaker plants powered by oil. We anticipate the two nuclear plants will need to stay. The hydro facilities we have will need to stay. As you can see, and you all have been debating, you know, through the last few weeks and today, what the cheap and best way forward will involve is a lot of homegrown energy. And that requires a build out of solar, and questions of where to place that are completely fair. And a continued build out of wind. We will need another component, and I know you all have been discussing the other component. We will need something that can be what we call clean, firm, dispatchable. We will need to build either long duration storage or nuclear or carbon capture on fossil or fossil plants that run off of a clean fuel. There's no getting around this, and the options aren't all that wide right now. I'm a former professor, so indulge me for a second, and then we will get to the money side. If you look forward through this modeling and say, what if Minnesota did not continue to move to clean? The red line and the orange line show that in two different ways. The red line says, what if we didn't continue the move to clean, and we don't care, and we care also about the health impacts, the environmental impacts of continued emissions from the system. If you look at that, that gives you the red line, going from 2023 to 2040. If you only care about the actual cost of the electric system, that gives you the orange line. So you want to discount the climate benefits, you want to discount the health benefits, and just say, what do my bills look like? That's the orange line. And then the black line assumes you are doing the 2040 plan. That pushes you to move faster to clean energy, which happens to be energy that, for the most part, has no fuel costs. And that is homegrown energy that reduces costs. As you see, the costs start to go down for the system because of this push to clean. You'll also note that as we get to 2040, the costs may come back up. Why is that? That's because we will need things like additional clean firm. And as we know, nuclear is not cheap right now. Long-duration storage is not cheap right now. Carbon capture and storage is not cheap right now. Alternative fuels for a fossil plant are not cheap right now. If those don't come down, the cost of the system would start to go up if we insist on meeting 2040. We think they can come down. But if they don't, there are safety measures in the 2040 legislation that would cause the PUC, under Commerce's advisement, to be able to waive far down the road some of the things that would drive those additional costs. So we work hand in hand with the PUC. You're going to hear from them next. And we do programs and policies. And Assistant Commissioner Polish is here to talk about that in the Q&A. Most of the funding that comes to DER is actually federal. Our current federal funding under contract is about $1 billion. That's not just for 1 year, it's for multiple years, but that's what we have under contract with the feds. Our annual state general fund ask this year is $14.25 million, and also for the second year of the biennium. Obligated federal grants to the Minnesota energy sector that aren't involving commerce, but we think are very important, are actually over $2 million. So we're looking at $3 billion of federal funding. The sources of our funding are ongoing state general fund appropriations. In our ask this year, we are asking for no new funding for DER programs in the budget proposal. Flat baseline and not a re-up of any of the 2023 programs in terms of additional funding. What we are asking for commerce is an operating adjustment, and these numbers are for commerce-wide, not just DER, of a little over $1 million in FY26 and closer to $2 million in FY27. That funding support would provide for commerce-wide additional support for current services, increase in employee compensation insurance, and upgrading our IT and other operating costs. And I'm sure Commissioner Arnold would be happy to answer any questions on that. That's it in terms of our ask for this year. I will point out we did have a lot of funding come our way in 2023, thanks to the legislative action. And we are still working through those programs. It is a large list. I'm not going to go through them. We feel like we have taken the legislative mandate and made good and careful use of those state funds, as is our charge, and done what we have been asked. And we are proud of how these many programs have been stood up and how they are running or ran in the case of programs that are already done. I'll give two examples. Our Solar for School program received a large boost in 2023. In 2024, we held two funding rounds. This is an expanded Solar for Schools program that supports K-12, state colleges, and universities now. It was a $30 million appropriation. We are still working through that money. Thus far, at the beginning of the year, 141 schools shown on this map have been funded in the program, totaling 18 megawatts of solar. I'll give just a second example. We have an electric grid resilience grant program that went out to RFP in 2024. These are grants to utilities from the state to work on resilience issues, to make sure that we have an affordable and reliable energy system going forward. $5.3 million was made available, $250,000 maximum per award. We received 40 applications from 29 applicants, way more than the funding was allowed. We have selected, but can't publicly announce yet because we haven't come to contract with all, but all of the awardees know that they are getting them and they are for important projects throughout the state for preserving reliability in the electric sector. We have ongoing federal funding, really only of three types, but important for us. You know that we do the Energy Assistance Program, which serves, importantly, Minnesotans throughout the state, providing a extremely important benefit for a state where the weather and the need for energy services can be severe. The federal allocation for this money, and it's all federal money, for this year was $125.5 million. We have 90% of the money waiting to see if the feds deliver on the last 10%. We update our dashboard weekly, and you can see that we have benefits that go to everywhere and actually are proportionally higher in outstate Minnesota. The other second of the three programs we have is weatherization assistance. Minnesota is proud for having run a federal weatherization program for many years that is remarked upon nationally for its high quality. That has been funded for the tune of $18 million a year. It has been supplemented by the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law. That supplement should be lasting for four more years. We are continuing to get the base appropriation, but the Trump administration has frozen, and it is not unfrozen yet, our bipartisan infrastructure law supplement. A third thing that is important for us, but not all that interesting to other people, is something called the State Energy Program. It allows us to do our energy security, our cybersecurity work, and to employ many of the folks in terms of salary who are necessary for implementing these state programs. We're also working through temporary federal funds that come from the IIJA, or the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, and the IRA. I am pleased to note that 2 weeks ago when I talked in front of the Senate, it was a situation where everything was frozen. I'd like to give some kudos to Attorney General Ellison and others who have, through court orders, unfrozen much of that money. And the money is, for the most part, flowing again as we speak, and we hope it stays that way. $273 million of federal money coming in through these formula programs to support Minnesota Energy. I'll end quickly with the fact that we in Minnesota have attracted many competitive funds. They are doing important things, like supporting the proposed build-out of a Niron Magnetics factory in Sartell, Minnesota, like supporting Great River Energy and other co-ops. Great River Energy has an $812 million grant from the IRA funds that will offset costs for rural Minnesotans. There are a bunch of these that we are tracking, and we are seeing good news in the last week about funds coming unstuck. So we are very happy with that. I will leave that overview of where our money comes from and your role in it and switch to questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Wyckoff, for being here. So I'm pleased to hear that a number of our funds have been unfrozen. That is really good news. You did mention, or maybe I just didn't quite catch it, I think it was on the weatherization assistance. Did I hear correctly that that is still not flowing?
Mr. Wyckoff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jones. For greater details, I will turn to Assistant Commissioner Polish, who is on the day-to-day update.
Assistant Commissioner Polish.
Chair, Representative Jones. As of today, the dollars are still frozen. They actually require a sort of proactive step by staff at Department of Energy, and we have not had a lot of communication from the Department of Energy. Just in the last few days, we've started to have program officers reach back out, so we're not clear if it's because of staffing issues and or some other reason that the dollars are frozen, but they've been frozen since January.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Polish. I'm wondering what effect is this having on the program? Has work just stopped or, yeah.
Which one would like that? Assistant Commissioner Polish.
And just, Chair, for the record, for future reference, shoe polish is exactly how you should remember to
polish.
Say that.
Polish.
Yeah, there you go. Representative Jones. We've had to shift all of the work that had been being done on WAP bill back over to other weatherization funds and ask service providers to stop doing any work on those accounts, which has led to concern and consternation amongst many of our service providers. You're not allowed to blend the two pots. You can't have a single project with both pots of funding, so they've had to pause work on some of the bill-funded projects, including sort of larger multifamily property. And so we're looking at other options to be able to continue moving those dollars forward with other funds that we have, but it has caused a bit of upheaval.
Representative Jones, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner Polish. This is concerning, right, that we live in a very cold state and we do not have the funds that are owed to us in order to upgrade these homes. That's Yeah, I'll just say that's very concerning. I'm also wondering, you didn't mention it specifically, but I am curious about, I know there was a grant to support kind of benchmarking and building performance, and I'm wondering where, if you have any knowledge where that grant sits.
Assistant Commissioner Polish.
Chair Swedzinski, Representative Jones. The website was launched last week, and all of the notices went out to all of the buildings that are covered by that program that they need to start entering their data. I was told within the first hour of it launching, there were already two buildings that were in compliance, which was thrilling until you saw how many other buildings that there were. But we are well on our way to getting that program, you know, moving forward. Buildings are coming in, and I think people are feeling really good about where we are in the process.
Representative Jones.
Awesome. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner Polish. That's great news. I'm also wondering, I believe we received a DOE grant around $8.5 million. I'm wondering if that has unfrozen as well.
Representative Polish, or Assistant Commissioner Polish. I just downgraded you,
and,
sorry.
No. Chair Swedzinski, Representative Jones. We just checked yesterday in the federal ASAP system, which is where you go to get the dollars, and $8.5 million are available for us to draw. It is a conditional award at this point. The conditions have not yet been lifted, but we are hoping that as DOE is now starting to set up more conversations with folks, that we're going to get more forward movement on that program as well.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, good. All right, Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I was going to ask about the energy assistance program. Glad to see that there's been some positive movement. My little basic math, if you had 90%, you're still looking for over 12. So maybe there's still a little yet to come, and hopefully it will. So what I want to do is just thank, I'm going to start with a thank you to the chair for having this conversation today. Really appreciate you finding time in the calendar for that. And thank you to Commissioner Arnold, Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff, and Assistant Commissioner Polish for being here and for the work you do. And as the landscape and the situation and our partnership with the federal government changes and shifts, I just hope that we can keep in good contact about how we can be a good partner to make sure that we can deliver on these really important programs. So thanks for being here. Thanks for the work that you do.
Well, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what Representative Akam said about, so I don't have to repeat all the names. No, it's great to see you all here. One quick thing on your chart about how the clean energy is saving us substantial amounts and then starts bending up a little bit towards 2035, 2040. I imagine that 2035 to 40 timeframe is based on what we know of current technology. And in that sense, am I wrong to say that it's probably conservative because there's a lot of technology developments and things that are happening in areas around here?
Chair.
Commissioner Wyckoff.
Thank you. Chair, Representative Kraft. So what we are benefiting from now is that certain technologies like short-term storage and wind and solar have already come way down through mostly deployment in the cost curve. And you were correct. We can hope that these other technologies will come down. It is really hard to predict in advance which technology will come down the cost curve, which is one reason why we at the Department of Commerce advocate for as much as possible a technology neutral approach. We don't know which of these will turn out to be the most cost effective, but none of them have yet. So I have enough experience with energy system models to know they do a lot of hand waving about, oh, we don't know. They're much better at things where there's an established track record mm-hmm. of, hey, it is actually getting deployed. Advanced nuclear is not getting deployed yet. Carbon capture on power plants is not getting deployed in any scale yet. So until those deployments start to happen, until you get the first, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, you can't really begin to speculate about how quickly the cost might come down. The same goes with long-duration storage.
Representative Kraft, follow up.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Sexton.
Good afternoon, Chair. Question on the second last slide with the grid. So speaking of grid, what exactly were the grid improvements where the grant money went to?
For this slide right here?
Yes.
Commissioner Wyckoff.
Sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative. So those are three different grants. One is through the Department of Commerce. It is a joint grant that we are basically administering, but it is us and six other states and utilities in those states, and also the two big balancing authorities that we work with. One's called MISO, I'm sure you know.
MISO.
Yep. And then a sliver of Western Minnesota is in what's called SPP, or Southwestern Power Pool. These, the grant to Commerce would fund five fairly short lines that connect SPP and MISO. And the nice thing about that, and it drives me nuts, there are times when electricity at the spot market is really expensive on the North Dakota side, but cheap here, and it would be great if we could sell across, it would benefit both sides. There are times when the opposite is true. It's those kind of seams grants, seams lines, that can really, for a short build-out of transmission and a lot of bureaucracies, because I mentioned seven states and utilities and two balancing authorities, if they can all collaborate, you can get huge benefits for not that much in terms of capital outlay. The other two grants are to Xcel Energy. It is for a variety of projects for Xcel and to Elite Minnesota Power, and that is for their high voltage direct current line that, when it is totally built out, will run from near Duluth to all the way into Montana, though the part that you know Elite is most responsible for does isn't the whole way.
Sure. So. Thank you.
Representative Sexton, follow up?
No, nothing further.
All right. And just going back to page 12, maybe Assistant Commissioner or Commissioner Wyckoff, just kind of looking at those different programs and funds and kind of the deployment of them, just kind of looking at kind of if we could get some numbers of what's left in some of these accounts and where those accounts are sitting as far as dollars, and then if you could associate where those dollars came from, if, you know, what their source funding was initially through the budgetary process. I'm just asking for that information. So thank you very much. And then are there any other questions from the body? Just in general, too, you know, looking at kind of the budget forecast as things came out, obviously we had a positive number in this biennium, but we are looking at some pretty decent numbers for the next biennium. And just, you know, as you're working and doing your worksheets and just, you know, it would be my goal is to try to take care of as much of that work in these 2 years, rather than wait for those next 2 years to try to help nip those numbers in the bud as much as we possibly can. So we'd love to work with you on finding areas of savings within your agencies and the rest and go from there. So Commissioner Arnold?
Chair Swizinski, thanks for that. And, you know, one of the reasons that you don't see any of the programs asking to be extended is a real focus on making sure that we're looking at the tails. And so we are happy to have conversations about that.
Sounds great. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much, you guys. Have a great day. All right, next on the docket, we have the Public Utilities Commission with their budget overview. If you guys would like to come forward. If you'd introduce yourself to the committee and.
All right. Just take a moment here to get set up.
Does it work? Are you going to be doing? Oh, there we go. Great.
Does that work?
You betcha.
Okay, great.
He's not only our executive director; he's also our IT guy.
That's not a good thing. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Will Seifert. I'm the executive secretary for the Public Utilities Commission. We appreciate the opportunity to give a agency overview and budget presentation. I'm going to try to read fast and probably skip over a couple slides because we want to honor your time here. First off, just about the agency, generally our mission. We are the oldest regulatory body in the state of Minnesota with our roots going back to 1874. What I want to reinforce to the committee is that the decisions that the agency makes impacts the lives of Minnesotans in a variety of ways, whether that's the rates charged by for-profit utilities, the quality of electric, natural gas, or landline telephone service, or the quality of life for those who live nearby energy generation and transmission, to name just a few. The Commission recognizes the importance of the decisions it makes and does so in adherence to the general and specific directives enacted by the legislature in Minnesota statutes. We implement the statutes as written and apply them to the facts in the administrative record in each case that comes before the Commission. We are a unique agency in state government with statutory authorities that are quasi-judicial, quasi-legislative, and administrative in nature. Statutes vest the power of the agency in five commissioners who are appointed by the governor and approved by the Senate and serve six-year staggered terms. This is an important slide, but I think I'm going to skip over it. The main takeaway is think of us like a court. We function, we're governed by open meeting law and ex parte restrictions so that our commissioners cannot interact with parties on matters that come before the agency outside of a public meeting. I'm also going to jump through this slide here quickly, but we're happy to come back and talk about the regulatory compact. If folks want to, I want to spend a minute here, though, on this slide. This highlights the primary areas of regulation for the PUC. Our regulatory authority over electric and natural gas utilities includes setting utility standards and rates, approving utilities' long-term plans, and ensuring service quality, among other things. PUC reviews requests by utilities and non-utilities that want to build large energy infrastructure projects like high-voltage transmission lines, power plants, solar farms, wind farms, storage facilities, and pipelines. The Commission is tasked with implementing or overseeing utility implementation of state energy policy. PUC actively participates in MISO and FERC proceedings as an individual member and as part of the Organization of MISO States and the Southwest Power Pool. And finally, the PUC also regulates service quality for local landline telephone service, but does not normally set the rates. About our staff here briefly, the PUC currently employs a staff of 77 FTE at its downtown St. Paul office in the Metro Square building. Most of our staff, as you can see from this slide, are in the regulatory analysis division. And then I'm going to keep moving, but I want to flag here real quick the consumer affairs office. So a small team of mediators that we employ at the commission. They're a great resource to your constituent services staff because they spend their days working with Minnesotans to help them resolve any issues they have with their utilities. And they're pretty busy doing that. I just highlight a couple slides that indicate how we're doing. So this captures some highlights of recent commission activities. So if we look back at rate petitions filed to the commission over the past 4 years, the PUC has rejected over $1.7 billion in proposed rate increases since 2020. This is the difference between what the public utilities have asked for in their rate cases and what the commission ultimately approved after these fully litigated proceedings. The Commission is able to make these decisions because of the hard work of consumer advocates and state agencies scrutinizing the requests and providing sound recommendations, in particular the Department of Commerce and Attorney General's Office. We manage roughly 765 unique dockets annually. As the energy industry is transitioning, these dockets are becoming increasingly complex, with greater levels of public participation and increased litigation risk. The PUC has emphasized reducing regulatory lag over the past few years and measured a 48% decrease in extensions issued in 2024. We saw and welcomed a significant uptick in public comments received across the 34 permit proceedings conducted in 2024, with over 7,000 public comments filed. Over the course of the year, there were 54 public hearings for these facilities dockets. The Commission is committed to public engagement and encourages broad-based participation in PUC work. The level of engagement helps fully inform commissioners so they can make the best decisions on matters before them. And finally, the Consumer Affairs Office, which I mentioned on the last slide, is very active as well, engaging in over 35,000 contacts with consumers and utilities annually. This small team of five mediators saved customers over $300,000 last year in bill credits and refunds alone. So this is our dashboard. I'm going to just flag here, we measure the work of the agency, the impact of the agency, in three different areas. Here is a snapshot of reliability. This shows the System Average Interruption Duration Index. This is a measurement of how quickly utilities restore power and is a comparison to our state-regulated utilities with their national peer utilities. And you can see The average for Minnesota IOUs, they're outperforming their national peers. For cost, here we look at the average electric bills that Minnesota homeowners pay in comparison to other states, and can see Minnesota utilities outperforming their peers across the country. And finally, for environmental performance, this metric looks at greenhouse gas emissions in the electricity generation sector. When you compare this to economy-wide greenhouse gas reduction goals in statute, the electricity sector is on pace to meet the targets codified in the Next Generation Energy Act, with CO2 emissions down 50% since 2005. Just want to take an extra slide here to highlight costs, since there's a specific goal in statute on this topic, rates in particular. Statute 216C.05 sets a goal to have retail electric rates for each customer class be at least 5% below the national average. On average, Minnesota IOUs are at 95% of the national average. While our utilities consistently meet this goal for residential customers, industrial rates, however, are above the national average. Thus, we're not meeting the goal for this customer class. This trend goes back to 2021. The Commission takes this very seriously and continues to work towards this goal as it evaluates utility performance. I'm going to go through our budget real quick, and then hopefully we have a little bit of time for questions. Now that you have a better sense of who we are, how we operate, and how we're performing, just want to flag our current, in the current biennium, the agency operated with an appropriation of $11.5 million in the first year and $11.39 million in the second year. 100% of the agency's expenditures are recovered through special assessment authority outlined in Minnesota statutes and returned to the general fund. Of that appropriation, roughly 95% of the agency's budget goes to staff compensation, office space, and IT support. The agency also administers the telephone assistance program from a special revenue fund. So the next two slides highlight four separate change items that are proposed in the governor's 26-27 budget. Similar to our current budget operating budget, these appropriations are recoverable through utility assessments and thereby returned to the general fund. The first proposal is an operating adjustment. This is an enterprise-wide adjustment proposed to offset budget pressures due to increases in things like employer-paid health care contributions, salary and compensation-related costs, as well as other operating costs. The second proposal is funding for a dedicated tribal liaison and associated cost to implement the requirements of Minnesota Statute 10.65. This is the tribal consultation statute, and as many of you know, the 2024 legislature added us to the list of agencies covered under this section of law. And finally, the last two proposals in front of you. This third proposal in the governor's budget is for natural gas utility resource planning and coordination. This request will support three FTE and modeling software licenses to address the Public Utilities Commission's new and increasing regulatory responsibilities for natural gas utility resource planning and coordination. This need is driven by recent weather events, policy changes, and industry trends. The final commission proposal in the governor's budget is an annual appropriation of $820,000 for technology maintenance and innovation. The PUC needs critical information technology resources and modernizations to efficiently perform its core regulatory tasks with public access and accountability. I'm going to skip through these next ones. I think we can come back since these are focused on implementation of recent legislation, and we're happy to come back and go through any of these slides. We just wanted to close out with a little bit of time in case you have questions about our budget request or anything else about the agency. Sorry I spoke quickly. I just wanted to make sure we got to the end and gave you a little bit of time.
That was zippy.
I'm not a professor like Dr. Wyckoff, but I can read quickly.
Members, do we have any questions? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for testifying today. I'm curious, you have a lot of unique dockets that come in front of the PUC, and I'm just kind of curious if you can give us the top two, three themes of kind of what you're seeing that kind of come in front of you, if you could, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative,
yes.
Great question. You know, in terms of what we're spending a lot of time on recently, there is an uptick in rate petitions from utilities, so we are spending a lot of time on our finance dockets. We're also spending a lot of time on resource plans. And as the committee understands, our public utilities file resource plans every couple of years, and that provides a 5- and 15-year planning horizon for the size, type, and timing of generation assets that they need to build to reliably serve. So Of the 765, that's probably only 5 or 6 dockets, but those are the most complex, they take the longest, and they have the most public participation.
Representative Baker. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've heard before in the committee that talking about the rates of Minnesota compared nationally with our electric rates, and that residential rates are somewhat below the national average, but commercial rates are above to a degree. Why is that? Do other states give breaks electricity rate wise for large consumption, or why do we lag in our rates for commercial users?
Mr. Seibert.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have a comparison analysis utility by utility of how other states do it. What I can tell you is when we get a rate petition, what we look at is first, what is the revenue requirement for the utility, right? How much do they need so they can reliably serve all of their customers? And then the second part of our analysis is what is the rate design, right? How do we allocate that among different customer classes? That is a contested, all of this is contested, but we look at cost of service analyses that are brought forward by various parties. And the idea, the underwriting concept is that you're paying for the system and to maintain the system for your needs. And so that's what explains the variance between different customer classes. But these are disputed. Oftentimes you'll have perhaps an industry group or the Attorney General's office or other entities that argue and provide data and analysis about why that should look differently. And so the commission's job is to read the record, apply the facts, and then make a final decision on that. I hope that helps you understand the process, but I can't tell you utility by utility how we compare against other states here.
Representative Anderson, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow up. I get that about building a system to handle their largest demand. And maybe this is getting into the minutia too, but I think about a fast charging electric vehicle station that when they're in use, they take large amounts of electricity, but maybe there are times when they aren't used at all. How do you plan for that? How do you charge rates for that? Or how do you handle situations like that?
Mr. Seifert.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I understand your question. So things like charging stations, the utility will come and plan out their system, right? And we'll approve a resource plan based on overall system needs. And then when they come back in and we review their next rate case, we'll compare their performance in what's called the test year, the next year, to make sure we're getting that right. But they're not coming in front of us with a charger by charger request for how those costs look. We're looking across their entire system to make those determinations about cost allocation and also their revenue requirements.
Okay. Representative Anderson. And just maybe I could just do a follow-up question, Mr. Seifert. Looking at, the question, Representative Anderson's was kind of that cost sharing, essentially, that program. How would you, so you have your cost classes, so you have industrial, commercial, residential, from a percentage of cost versus a percentage of use. So I don't think you had that in a slide, but that would be something it'd be interesting to kind of look at. So as you have from a consumptionary standpoint and then how you relate that, because obviously industrial is elevated for a reason, and then what percentage of that usage of, from a bill standpoint does that cover? If you could produce that at some point, I know you probably don't have that on you. So Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Seifert and Mr. Bull. Appreciate you guys being here today. I wanted to maybe just clarify Representative Anderson's question in terms, he was making the comment about commercial rates. Those are actually below average. It's the industrial rates that are above average. It's been confused a couple of times, and I just wanted to set it straight for the record. And what I will say is that, I've been on the Energy Committee now. This is my 7th year. And what I will say, and just for myself, that the Public Utility Commission for me is a little bit of a dark black hole, like there's so much about it. It's very complicated and there's so much about it that I don't understand. I so appreciate all the work that you do to work towards affordability, reliability, safety, and all of that for all of us. I
when we're not as busy as now, but it would be great to somehow work to have like a PUC 101, something to kind of, I know I'm not the only one who's not an expert in the PUC, but just to better understand, because I think in so many cases or instances, what we're doing is in line with what you're doing, or at least working on the same issues, and to better understand overlap and not so. Anyway, I just plant a seed there with that. And I'm going to just say, because it's one of my favorite things that we've heard so far this year, that when MISO came and did their presentation, I'm just going to emphasize again that they said Minnesota was the most reliable within the MISO region, and appreciate your work to help make that happen. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Seifert, I'm pretty sure there's a big question in there. You got to figure out which one you want to answer.
I was just going to say we don't want to be a dark hole, so that's why we're here. And unfortunately, much of our PUC 101 I had to jettison in trying to get through this in the time allocated. But we're happy to come back. Generally speaking, you all pass the statutes and create the policy structure, and the commission then acts as a panel of judges and regulates the utilities to ensure that they are complying with those laws, and they're doing so in a way that ensures safe and reliable and affordable service to your customers, your constituents.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Seifert and Mr. Bull, for being here. I'm excited to really dive into these types of things. I have a number of questions, actually. Can you help me understand what triggers resource plans and rate cases? How often do they come? Can you say more about that?
Mr. Seifert, and then if you have a question related to the sheet at all, that might just help other members, just tell us the page if it, you know.
Oh.
It's good, though.
I don't think
Mr. Seifert,
that one was.
Yeah, it's all good. But I'm just, if it does.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So in terms of rate cases, the way the law is structured, when a utility needs additional revenue to serve its customers, it brings us a rate case. So we have some utilities that have avoided having to bring in rate cases. Otter Tail, Dakota are some of the utilities that don't come in with great frequency or haven't come in recently. And then others, Xcel Energy, that is coming in a little bit more recent in recent years. But that's more a function of the utility's financial needs and what they need to build out their system. The general cadence, however, though, so that customers can aren't surprised, is when they do file rate petitions, they usually come in on November 1. Interim rates take effect at the beginning of the year, and then we have what's supposed to be a 10 to 12 month process to get to a final rate decision. So that's the cycle for rate cases. Resource plans, the law is set up in a way that resource plans are supposed to come every 2 years, and then the decision in the resource plan is a 5 and a 15 year investment horizon. Okay. In practice, what's happening with resource plans is because they are so extensive and they require so much public participation, and oftentimes parties and the utilities will file updated models as the circumstances change. It might take us a year and a half to 2 years to get through a resource plan. So when we get to the end of the resource plan, one of the decisions at the end of the, in the order for the resource plan, is always a schedule for when they're supposed to file their next. And that's usually within a year or two of that resource plan being issued.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Seifert, for that. If I can just so clarify, especially so on resource plans, we're always doing resource planning then.
Correct. That's correct.
Yeah.
And in addition
Mr.
to that,
Seifert?
Mr. Chair, sorry, and Representative, the legislature's also added some additional planning requirements over the last couple of years. So while we're doing system-wide resource planning on this constant cycle, we're also doing distribution plans from all the electric utilities. We're doing transportation electrification plans for all the utilities. We're also starting to do gas resource plans so we can better plan for some of the fluctuations in that commodity.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you. That's really helpful. Related, and I don't believe this is a part of your purview, but I think you may be able to answer this, or someone from the department maybe. ECO, what is the commission's role with regards to ECO?
Mr. Seifert.
Yeah, my deputy here has been waiting to jump in.
Well, so not just a pretty face. our role with the commission's role, Representative Jones,
Chair Swedzinski. Our role with regard to ECO is to review the costs of the of investor-owned utility plans and the recovery of those plans, as well as we review the energy efficiency resource that the utility is planning to get from its customers to benefit its customers in their resource plan. So it's part of the part of a resource plan to set the goal for energy efficiency resource that then will go be acquired by a utility through a TECO plan.
Representative Jones.
Thank you. That's helpful. So it's basically within the resource plan, we think of energy efficiency as a resource, and right. So it's captured in that, and so that helps to guide then the ECO planning process, which, as I understand it, then it goes through the department.
That's correct. Yeah.
Mr. Bull.
Thank you.
Representative Jones, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, so I have a separate question, and this one is on a page, so let me find it. It's with regards to, page 9. You mentioned a 640% increase in comments on dockets in the last number of years, and I'm just curious, why? Do you know?
Mr. Bolt?
Mr. Seifert. No problem, Mr. Chair, Representative. That actually is going to lead me to maybe amend my answer to Representative Baker on his first question. Much of that's driven by facilities applications. We are experiencing a pretty significant uptick in proposals in front of the commission for projects that require a PUC permit. So this is wind, solar, transmission lines, pipelines, all of that. And with that, we hear a lot from the public. We want to hear from the public, quite frankly. We try to make that easy, but a lot of those comments are about projects, and the increasing volume of projects is another trend we're seeing at the commission.
Mr. Seifert, my guess would be a lot of it is because of the transmission lines that were probably a general large uptick on that.
We are at this point in the midst of working through tranche one of MISO's long-range transmission planning permits. So, yes, there are a number of decisions for those various lines that we're working through at this time.
Representative Jones.
Thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions? Going once? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. You were easy on us.
We appreciate the time.
All right. Well, members, that is all we have for today. Our next meeting will be Tuesday, March 11th. This meeting is adjourned.